Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery. With the answer to the age-old question of what's for dinner with chef-prepared food-to-go favorites, your food is our passion.
Valerie Friedland is a linguist. She's an expert on accents. And in her new book, she says, what provides a sense of belonging in every human society is the way we sound. So when that sound changes or no longer matches the world around us, that's when we feel its power most clearly. Friedland was raised surrounded by one of the most recognizable accents in America, but for the longest time, she didn't hear it.
I grew up in Memphis, Tennessee, definitely an accented place that was aware of its accent. All my formative accent years were there, and I didn't notice that my parents sounded different. I was so acclimated to their accent, which was French, that I had no idea they had an accent. But what would happen is kids would come play at my house, and the first thing they always said the minute my mother opened her mouth to offer them something was, oh my gosh, why does your mom sound like that? And that was my first realization that my parents sounded funny, like they didn't sound like me. I couldn't hear it because I had been trained in their accent as well as the ones of my friends, but it was a really striking revelation at a very young age that sounds mean something. They mean something social, and they can set us apart or make us feel like we're part of something, depending on the perspective of who's noticing. But then I left to go to Georgetown for college. And most people I went to college with were not from the South. And that was the first time that anybody called me out for an accent as being different. One of the things I really remember is the way I pronounced the word lawyer as liar, because I was Southern, and someone kept saying, what? Who's a liar? Who's a liar? They didn't hear that I was talking about a lawyer. They heard I was talking about a liar, someone who lies. And you can say what you want about lawyers, but that was not the meaning I was intending. And it made me feel really uncomfortable because they did it to me in front of other people. The biggest shock was not only that I sounded different, but that people thought I sounded strange and made me feel like I didn't connect to them because of it. That was, I think, my first recognition that accents are socially powerful. When they're the same as the people we're around, they kind of bond us, and we don't even realize that they're bonding us because it's just the way everybody talks. So it's the ultimate call out of an outsider to sort of call them out by their accent. I love linguistics. I love the sort of nuts and bolts of how language works. And I think that's the side of language that people never see. For an example, if you ever think about the plural S, if I ask anybody, well, how do you say, you know, you have not just one cat, you have two of them, they would stick an S on the end. And if you ask them what they did, they'd say, oh, I stuck an S on the end. But actually, you're not sticking an S on the end. You're only sticking a plural marker on the end that actually can come out as an S, a Z, or an EZ. So you can have cats, dogs, or horses. And that's a really interesting nuanced pattern that people don't realize they do, but they do it every single time they say words that end in certain sounds. So that nuts and bolts part that's fascinating to me was also something I wanted to get across in a way that everyday speakers could understand it without having their eyes glaze over as they would in a general linguistics class. So it was really two parts. It was, here's the really fascinating underbelly of language that you've never had insight to. And then also, here's the incredible history and social motivations for accents that you also probably have never been privy to. So it's really two sides.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Valerie Friedland is with us today. Her book is Why We Talk Funny. And at first, like us, you're going to be interested in the part where she breaks down accents, like the elements of a drawl or the Utah accent, which, of course, we get to. But Friedland goes further than that, because Accents, she says, aren't just quirks of pronunciation, they're social clues. She takes us inside the science and the psychology of how we hear and judge one another. And she reveals how language, identity, and belonging are all deeply intertwined in the way we speak. And if you think you lost the accent of your hometown, or that you don't really have an accent to speak of, you're wrong. And that's where we began the conversation with the question, does everyone have one?
Yes, of course. We don't recognize it usually because we're around people that sound like we do. And I think, you know, there's this common belief that an accent is something that's not standard, rather than that standard speakers also have accents. And that's just sort of a common myth. But, you know, if you've ever, even as a standard speaker, left your country of origin and gone somewhere else, even somewhere English is spoken, you get flagged by the way you sound the minute you walk off that plane. In fact, before you even walked off that plane, because you're surrounded all of a sudden by all these people that have different accents than you. So, you know, it's sort of silly when we think about it, because we obviously know we have accents, because if you went to Australia, you would have an American accent. But when we're home, all of a sudden we're accentless because we just don't think we stand out. And just because you don't stand out doesn't mean you don't have an accent. It just means you don't have one of the accents where we have features that get called out because it indicates something social about you. So, you know, when you have a standard middle-class accent, it says basically often that you are white, that you're middle class, that you're of a certain age. I mean, there's a lot of things we associate with a certain way of talking that might not be realized by the people that are using that speech. But you absolutely have an accent, no matter who you are.
When someone says, I really worked hard to get rid of my accent, like I grew up in a rural part of, you know, the country or whatever, and they said, it really took me a while to get rid of that accent. What's going on there? What are they saying? Because they haven't gotten rid of an accent. Maybe they've gotten rid of certain, I guess, characteristics, which we'll talk about, but what's going on when someone says that? Because it seems like there's a lot packed in there.
There is. Yeah, that's probably a 12-part question.
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
But let's just start with the first part of that, which is this idea of losing an accent, which is an odd thing. You know, you lose this feature of your personality. You know, that's like losing being happy or losing being sad. You don't really lose an accent as much as you shift it or morph it or massage it to fit an identity that you're interested in inhabiting.
Yeah.
I think that's the better way to talk about it.
Yeah.
But you know, our identities are very impactful on the way we'll talk, but the identity you had as a child, the identity you have as an adolescent is actually the most important in the accent you're going to end up speaking as an adult. And your brain is also different, and the types of interference you have from an existing dialect is different when you are a child or an adolescent, because you have less there to block the way of learning this accent or learning this dialect. But when you move and you want to change that identity or that accent that matches it, you have all this baggage from the original one you had. And whether you think of that baggage as good or bad, it's always going to be there. Can we learn some aspects of a new accent? Absolutely. Can we ever lose the one we had? Not really. But can we kind of get a blended accent that combines aspects of both? Certainly. Whether you'll do that or not is not a guarantee, because it really depends on a number of factors. How old you are when you move, or when you have this shift in identity that you want to use your accent to help portray. How integrated into the new community, whether it's one that's new in your space that you already live in or a new place. And also how much exposure to people with that accent you get in your everyday life, and how much motivation you have to sound like that. You know, a lot of people that want to lose their accent want to lose it because they think something is wrong with the one they have. And that makes me sad, because accents are so beautiful and classic and parts of our identities and who we are and the people we love and where we come from. But I also get it, because there's a lot of accent hate that goes around. And it's natural for people that might think, oh, I want to leave my community and see the world, but I don't want the accent that maybe people think something about me because of to follow me. Or I want a different job, and if I have this accent, I can't get that job. So I think people in broadcasting often feel that way.
Yeah.
So I understand the reasons and the motivations, and there's nothing wrong with it. But I think we also just need to be careful to recognize that when you gain an accent, you also are forfeiting parts of the identity that the other accent gave you.
I want to ask a little bit about the actual field of study here, like how it works, the mechanics of what it is you are trying to identify. It sounds like a lot of this is about mapping out sound.
Right. I think that's a really good question, because a lot of times people ask me to talk about accents or other aspects of the things I study in the social life of language. But it's sort of this vague idea of how I actually collect the data that gives me the information. So, what do sociolinguists do? How do we collect data? And, a lot of it's field work. A lot of it is by actually going out and talking to people. Most of the research I've done has been involving collecting data where I have a group usually that I want to study. It's usually not just a single group, but maybe a comparative group. So, my dissertation, for example, was looking at Southern speech in comparison to Northern speech, because my generation had changed a lot in the way they spoke, but people had these really strong opinions about what Southerners sounded like. And none of my friends sounded that way. And I grew up in the South, an urban area of the South. So that's a pivotal distinction with rural areas in terms of the way dialects are moving. But I had to go and actually collect data from a lot of Southerners and a lot of Northerners. And so I would bring really high-tech recording equipment, because I'm analyzing their speech on a computer. So I'm breaking down the formant structures of the waveforms of their speech.
Wow.
So it's not just me going and sticking a microphone in someone's face and saying, say pen and pen.
Yeah.
It's actually me going, and I have them read a lot of things. We have a conversation. There are certain target sounds I'm looking at. And then I go back and I actually transcribe what they said. And then you kind of analyze the vowel frequencies on the computer. And so I had to do that in all the places I studied. And you usually need about 100 people. Mm. I also then was interested in how it affected the way we hear sounds. So my question was, does the way that we listen to other people's speech get affected by our own speech? Do we hear things the same way no matter how we talk? And so then I actually had to do experiments that people would hear different sounds and tell me what they heard. So that was all done on computer. And I could do that more remotely. But then the trick was, I often want to get the same information. So I'd want to record someone and then also record their perception. So that required also interaction. And this is generally what sociolinguists do. We go out in the field, we do field work, and then we do a sort of more sophisticated analysis. So it's not just me listening to someone saying, hey, look at those vowels. Those are cool. Let me talk about them. It's actually getting measurements and comparing them across different places or groups. And then you can plot them actually on an acoustic map, so to speak, and just visually see how people are different.
It was really interesting. You mentioned that there's something like 800 possible speech sounds that they've found across languages. But in any one language, we use between maybe 20 or 40 of those. So will you talk a little bit about that? I guess the idea of acquiring language and then ultimately how it's translated into an accent is about the way we use those sounds. Is that right?
Yeah, that's, I'd say, a very good, accurate description. There's a lot of stuff that goes into the acquisition of an accent. And one big part of it is that, when we're born, we're kind of all born with the same brains. And our brains are naturally attuned to the patterns in speech around us, so that even though we know nothing, babies don't come into the world knowing words and word meaning. They don't have any of the tools that adults do to analyze the speech around them. So as an adult speaker, if someone says dog, that's da-a-og, and that's one word with three separate sounds, because you know something about the structure of your language, and you've learned something about that being a word, and that words have subparts called sounds, and that there are a certain number of sounds per words. But think about a baby. I mean, they can't even poop, right, on their own. Well, they poop on their own, but they can't clean it up.
Yeah.
They have no real skills. So you're asking this, child that really is born a blank slate in terms of what they know about the world. in word meaning and where words end and other ones begin to figure out all the sounds of their language, which is immensely hard. And if you've ever gone to a country where they spoke a language you knew none of, you get that same experience of being a baby born into this language model where everything is just a stream of speech. Because when you go, say you don't speak Russian, you go to Russia, you're not going to know where one word ends and another begins. But the clues you follow as a baby are these statistical tendencies for sounds that are meaningful in a language to only occur in certain places. And this is when I was talking about the nuts and bolts of language, how cool it is. And so babies are doing a process called statistical learning, where they're analyzing from all the speech coming at them from their mothers and fathers cooing at them and, you know, doing baby talk to them and everybody else they overhear. They're actually doing this incredibly sophisticated statistical analysis. And from that information, they are able to say, oh, look, P is a sound in my language, but ba isn't. So they can actually tell from just the way that sounds pattern which ones are those 20 to 40 sounds in their language and which ones they can learn to ignore because they're not going to be important.
So accents also come about, as you say in the book, a byproduct of becoming the socially attuned creatures that we are. So they have the sounds that they've worked out by, you know, one or so. And you say they're identifying an accent. So at what point are they identifying? Let me put it as a question. At what point are they identifying an accent in the realm of social position? Like, how much do babies notice, or young kids, and have opinions about the accents they hear around them? I mean, you think of babies as this kind, as these kind of guileless creatures just taking in stimulus. But I wonder, are they already making judgments about accents?
Are they already judgy?
Yeah, are they judgy early? Yes. That's the question.
You know, okay, so let me step back to say, you know, there are different ways that we could qualify this. Do babies notice speech that's different than their own at a very young age? The answer to that is yes. Yeah. Do they judge it socially? The answer to that is no. Okay, so they're not judgy yet, but they are highly attuned to noticeable differences in the sounds that hear around them or that speakers they hear around them. And by that, I mean by even as early as 5 months old, a baby will turn its head more towards someone who's speaking in the same speech they hear at home than someone that has a different accent. So if someone's speaking a different language or their language with a different accent than the one that baby's parents speak, they do seem to notice that difference, and they're more attracted to people that sound like the ones they hear at home in terms of, you know, taking a toy from them or turning their head towards them. So we do seem to have a spidey sense for noticing accents early on, but there's zero evidence that they have any judgy feelings about these accents until they hit about kindergarten. Hmm. So around 5 is when most studies show that babies start, or not babies anymore, children, young children start to have feelings about the people who have accents different than their own. And they're not still necessarily disparaging those that have different accents as much as preferring people and other kids that have the same accent they do. So they tend to rate teachers with the same accent they have as better teachers. And they seem to flock towards children as friends that have a similar accent. And that's actually even stronger than race as a determinant of friendship in kindergarten, because we find that if someone is of the same race but speaks with a different accent, children are less likely to say they'd want to be friends with them than someone of a different race that speaks with the same accent. So I'd say by 5, we're getting slightly judgy. And then, of course, by teenage years, it's like all judgment lets loose. And we're very, very judgy on many things other than accents as well as accents.
Valerie Friedland, she's a professor of linguistics at the University of Nevada, Reno. Her new book is Why We Talk Funny, The Real Story Behind Our Accents. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
The Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, with the answer to the age-old question of what's for dinner with chef-prepared food-to-go favorites. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the linguist Valerie Friedland is with us. We're talking about her new book about accents, which is more than just how regional speech works. It's about the story of language itself. Accents, she says, can signal where we belong, where we're from, but they can also shape how we're perceived, who gets trusted, who gets judged. She explores why we hear accents the way we do and what they say about the human need to fit in or stand out. The book is called Why We Talk Funny. Of course, we've always had accents, but do you have a sense of when they may have started to matter? When did we start to pay attention to them? You quote this linguist named Jack Chambers, who said, "So persistent and pervasive are the social judgments of language use that they must be embedded in human nature." So tell us more about what we know about how accents evolved, I guess, is the question.
Right. And, you know, I think a lot of times we think of accents as just these sort of things that set us apart that are born out of someone not learning to speak correctly. I mean, that's really a lot of what we think of accents, why we think there is an accentless form that everybody else is aspiring to but doesn't quite meet the bar of. That's sort of a lot of times our sense of accents, not that they're useful in any way, but more that they're about people not learning language in the right way, or, you know, having been separated and then learning things differently. But the reality is, if you think about what accents do for us, they do two things. They really bond us to people that matter to us, that can do things for us that are advantageous to us. So the people in our communities, the people in our homes, the people we like, we love, that give us jobs and nurture and things like that. But they also set us apart from people that we're different from. And maybe that could be dangerous in some ways, at least from an evolutionary standpoint. So we have to assume, and not dangerous today, but I'm talking about way back when, the purpose they would serve. We have to assume that accents have always served those purposes, and that that was why natural selection would have favored those that could perceive accents better than those that couldn't, because they would be doing the hard work of recognizing outsiders and recognizing insiders. And think back to when, you know, you were in tribes that were spread out of Africa across the world. And if you, you know, didn't know this person and you could call out and see if they were a person in your tribe and understand just from hearing them say, you know, the equivalent of hello, whether you might be safe or not with them, whether they might help you or not, that would be very useful. Certainly more useful to getting very up close where they could stab you before you had a chance. So it does seem like accents served a purpose and have long done so. And if you think about the 7,000 or so languages that exist today, well, you have to assume that from a, you know, deep evolutionary standpoint of language development, at one point they all came from an original source language. Mm-hmm. And all of them at one time were accents of that language. And then the more distant you are from each other, the less you talk, the more accents turn into languages. So really the evolution of language is you go from a language, and then that language gets separated somehow from groups of speakers that say it differently. So over miles and mountains, for example. And then eventually they are separate for so long that these natural changes that happen in language, no matter who we are, just make those languages change so much in different ways that they're no longer intelligible and they become separate languages.
I think you tell this great story of the Greek historian Herodotus, who had heard this story from these Egyptian priests who were trying to sort of come up with, and this Egyptian pharaoh, who was trying to figure out the original, you know, the legit language. And the experiment they conduct is really, do you mind talking about that?
No, that's such a fun sort of, it's like the world's first social experiment.
Yeah, yeah.
There was an Egyptian pharaoh that lived in, you know, 7th century or so BCE. Psammeticus was his name. And he was really curious about how he could go about proving that somehow the ancient Egyptians and their language were the sort of original one. They were the original people in the original language. And he thought, well, It's got to be that whatever we start speaking when we're out of the womb or we're, you know, unhindered by experience with people, that would be the original language, right? This sort of evolutionary standpoint of, you know, language springs forth just naturally from the baby when it's born. And so he thought, well, let me snatch up some babies because, you know, I am the king. Why not? And put them in isolation with no one speaking to them, right? So this experiment where you would not have any input linguistically speaking, and maybe just someone to take care of them, because obviously babies need food, and then see what comes out. And that whatever comes out must be the first original language. And of course, his complete expectation was that it would be ancient Egyptian. And he walked in one day, the babies were about 2 years old, and they were saying, Pecos, Pecos, Pecos. But when Sebeticus heard the word that the babies had said, he was very downtrodden, because it turns out there was not a word bekos in ancient Egyptian, but instead there was it was the word for bread in Phrygian, which was a neighboring language and a neighboring tribe, neighboring group of people. And so he dejectedly assumed that that meant that they were the most primordial and original people. It was actually one of the first of several experiments of its kind. Several other kings and emperors had the same idea to see what came out. And in no cases did it end successfully. And in no cases really did anybody figure out what that OG language was.
I want to talk about the, because you go through this in the book, the way Americans developed an accent in comparison to the Brits. It seems like the R is the way to, the way we pronounce our R's is the way to talk about this, because you say the difference in the way we pronounce the R is maybe the most striking example of how that flexibility of language is tied to, you know, those shifts in social and sort of cultural things. So take us through what the R tells us about all of this. And yeah.
Yeah, the R is a great example because there are a lot of differences, obviously, between British and American speech, and also between different British varieties and different American varieties. But the nice thing about R is it really tells the story in a way that mirrors kind of all these other ways that sounds have changed in a very uniform sort of trajectory of the way that we have become separate over time from Britain. And, you know, if you look back into the colonial era and you think about the very first colonists to the New World, they were British. Yeah. The majority of them were British, or at least the ones at that era that settled the New World and had an impact on our speech. So yes, there were other colonists there already, right? So, you know, for example, New York area was a Dutch colony. And then there were Spanish colonies too. So we weren't alone there, but the British were the ones that really had an impact on defining America's dialects today. So let's start with the British colonists. They would come over, they would sound pretty much like everybody back at home. But it was really quick, maybe within couple of generations, that we started to have a distinctly American sound. And, you know, it continued to evolve to the point we are today, where we sound very, very different. Yeah. So, you know, obviously there are big differences, but the nice thing about R is it tells us a lot of things about how those differences develop. The first thing about the R is, you know, we have all our R's in American speech. So there are a few pockets, of course, where you have, you know, Harvard,
yeah,
where the R is lacking in certain cases. But generally speaking, American speech is what we call rhotic or R-full, meaning everywhere an R is written, it's pretty much pronounced. But if you look at Southern British speech, especially upper class Southern British speech, it's non-rhotic, which means they drop R's in certain words. And so ca, hot for heart. Those R's get dropped. And what's really interesting is while people tend to associate that with sort of upper class ancient speech forms, it's actually the newer version of British speech than American English is, because the pronouncing of all our R's is actually the OG in that case. British speech, even in the South, was an R-pronouncing dialect until about the 19th century. That's when it really became widespread to drop R's. So that's a case where it's actually a sort of vestige of earlier British speech that we still have in American speech, because the colonists came before that happened in British speech. But then we get places like Boston and New York, where you get that R dropped some, and it used to be dropped even more, right? It's kind of dying out now. So the question is, you know, how does that happen then? Because a lot of people think it was just sort of retained from older British forms when it's actually the opposite. Well, that's because coastal areas, places that had ports, maintained a lot more contact with London. And that was where R dropping became really posh in the 19th century. And originally in Britain, it actually was considered a vulgar habit to drop your R, but enough vulgar people influenced the non-vulgar people that the non-vulgar people picked it up and were like, wow, this is cool. Let's stick with it. And that it was those people that then brought it to America. And it was really in the 19th century in places like Boston and Charleston and New York, where they looked to London as kind of the beacon of style, both in clothing and in other aspects of culture, but also in speech. And that's where we get things like the dropping of R and the pronunciation of the a vowel as ah, like in aunt for aunt. That's also considered posh. So it's this really interesting cycle of, you know, we did sort of what was originally British and kept it, whereas the British actually changed away from their older forms. And then because of different degrees of contact in the New World, people that had a lot of contact and looked towards the English still picked up traits that were new in English speech, but the rest of the country, which didn't have a lot of contact and probably didn't want it, because a lot of the settlers, like the Scotch-Irish that formed the Midland Heartland dialect area, didn't really have a lot of love for those in London. So they kept their R-ful speech. And then as wars progressed, so we had the Civil War and then the Revolutionary War. We had the Revolutionary War first and the Civil War, and then the World War I and II, the prestige of Britain waned across all of that. And as that waned, we moved further and further away from R-ful speech to the point where now it's a dying feature of all accents of American English.
The thing I really liked about the story of how this developed was the way you mentioned the need for collaboration and community was, as you write in the book, vital to the establishment and continuity of each colony. So we were in this wilderness place. We're trying to connect to each other. We're trying to establish a community and connections. And one of the ways we do this just naturally is we start to sound alike.
Right. We start, it's called leveling, accent or dialect leveling. And, you know, I think the really pivotal part of life in the New World was people were trying to survive, and survival was tough. In fact, a lot of people didn't. You interacted in a way that you would not have back in Britain or wherever you came from, because your very survival depended on collaboration and cooperation of a nature that you would never have had to have back home. So whenever that happens, when you need each other and when you work together, and the more you interact, that makes you do something called speech accommodation. And it's a natural tendency we have. So, you know, we still have it anytime we talk to anybody. If you go have a conversation with your neighbor, you may have no accent in common with your neighbor. Maybe they're from some place completely different. But if they mention that they saw a bunny in their yard that day, you're probably not going to call it a rabbit. You'll call it a bunny, because that's what they said, right?
How considerate.
Isn't that nice of you? And that's just this natural tendency we do that's mimicking of other people's speech that we are having a conversation with. So think about that on a grand scale. You have a bunch of people in this intense social experiment and survival experiment, working together, talking together, where their very survival was based on their ability to communicate and work together. And so they had to be able to understand each other. So that's a great motivation for accommodation, if I've ever heard of one. Mm-hmm. And so it's really that, you know, melting pot of these different accents and types of people that had to learn to work together and talk together that forged the first American sounds.
You mentioned in the development of these regional differences that start to cook and brew, that the Southern drawl came late to the party. That surprised me.
I think a lot of what people would be surprised about is all the accents we think of as sort of stereotypically American and distinctive, the New England accent and the West Coast accent and the Southern accent. all kind of developed in the last century or two. They're not old. They're not that old. In fact, the first few hundred years of the New World, people remarked more on how everybody in the New World sounded similar rather than different. And that was remarkable because back in Britain, everybody sounded so different. And in fact, the dialect diversity in Britain was the bar to which Americans were always compared, you know, up to about the Revolutionary War. And it's not till about 1800 or late 1700s that we start to see the first twinkle in regional dialect eyes. And that seems to be more about probably when people were worried about the fragile union among the states and they didn't want anything that would tear them apart. So people started paying more attention to the differences that divided us. So the Civil War was really foundational in establishing what we hear today as the Southern dialect region, because up to that point, the South didn't have the same type of cohesive identity that we think of it having today. And when we look at old records, our Civil War veterans questionnaires, or these enclave communities that were formed by people that fled after the Civil War, so they have this unique Southern variety that was kind of a time capsule, what we find is things like the pin-pen merger, the use of y'all, the drawl. None of those things appeared until after the Civil War. So it's a pretty new accent.
Valerie Friedland, her new book is Why We Talk Funny: The Real Story Behind Our Accents. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners like you. Become a member at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the linguist Valerie Friedland. We're talking about her book, Why We Talk Funny. I want to get us to the West because I have some questions about the Utah accent. Give us a sense of, if the Southern drawl comes late to the party, I guess the Western accent develops quite late as well. And how would we describe a so-called Western act? I mean, you mentioned how there's still some Southern influence in the Central Valley of California, for example. So talk a little bit about the Western accent, as you know, about.
Sure. You know, the West was settled a lot later than the East Coast. So it's a much more recent accent. And what's really fascinating, because I think a lot of people think there's really no Western accent, that's one of those places they think is accentless. And part of the reason that we think of it that way is because if you think about the history of settlement on the mid-Atlantic coast versus the Pacific coast, who was settling there was quite different. So when we have the early dialects getting established down the eastern seaboard, you had people from not just Britain, but you also had the Scots-Irish, you had Germans, you had, you know, French Huguenots, you had the Dutch, you had a Swedish colony, you had a Finnish colony, you had a lot of people coming with different accents and different language backgrounds. And those were really the important foundational accents of along the East Coast. But you have to skip ahead 200 years to really get to the Western English accent even being a thing, because it wasn't until after the Gold Rush that we had massive amounts of people resettling out west. And that was a very different kind of settlement pattern than these non-native accents that were foundational, as well as the British, to the founding of Eastern settlements. Then you had another leveling. So you had the first leveling, which created American accents, which made us different than Britain. But then in 1850, 1860, you had all these people coming from northern dialect regions and southern and midland dialect regions moving west. And now they had an American English leveling. So you had a second leveling. And that is part of the reason we think of the West as being this homogenous dialect region, because it was settled by a foundationally different type of settler than the first colonies that were in the New World. And that gave rise to what we think of as the Western accent.
That gets us, I think, to Utah. I mean, I think those of us who live here know we have an accent, and the Utah accent is endlessly fascinating to us at Radio West. We've been really interested about it. You mentioned in your book a linguist here in Utah, BYU linguist Joey Stanley, who wrote about this change in the pronunciation of words like mountain and button.
So you glottalize it. You're glottalizing it.
That's what I'm doing. Uh-huh. Yeah.
That's the fancy linguistic term for that.
Got it.
You know, and so that's a really interesting context. So, the Joey Stanley did a lot of writing on the changing pronunciation of words like mountain and kitten, and that it had a very specific Utah bent where that it wasn't just the glottalization. It was also that vowel that's in that second syllable that became a little more articulated. Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
Not just mountain, kitten. And that became kind of stigmatized as being, you know, strong Utah pronunciation. And so then people hyper-articulated to mountain or kitten. And what's funny
is... Why would we to counter it, to say, I'm not that kind of Utah?
Yeah, exactly. Huh. Because once something gets noticed and there's a social salience put on it, and, you know, a negative one sometimes, depending on your perspective, people can sometimes hyper-correct.
Oh, man, I hear that all the time. The mountain. I hear that a lot.
Yes. And so that's actually a newer version that has been born from kind of trying to linguistically flee from mountain, kitten. That pronunciation that became widespread. And so once something gets heard as somehow, you know, not a positive pronunciation for whatever reason, then people slowly move away from it or rapidly move away from it sometimes to try to, you know, get away from whatever social associations have been put on it. And that one seems to have gotten this, like, you know, local yokel Utah kind of affiliation or association, and therefore people hyper-articulated this mountain form. And what was interesting, with Doug, is when you said it the first time, you said it in the hyper-articulate way, mountain.
Of course, yes.
Right. And then you corrected yourself. You're like, mountain.
Yeah. Yep.
So I'm wondering what you actually say.
I know, that is the question.
Out at a bar with your friends.
Yeah. Well, there's a linguist named Derek Driggs. He has a great Instagram account, and he also talks about the Utah accent all the time. And one of the things he mentioned is how in Utah we've shortened the vowels, so feel becomes fill. I feel
that's
sick. That's
Utah.
One.
Right.
Yeah, and then the other one is just that we sort of overemphasize or extra emphasize the consonants. So, like, running becomes running at the end.
Yes.
I don't know. Do you know anything about that part of the Utah accent?
Yeah, it's not just Utah. That's a sort of Western associated feature. In fact, it's been called out by people in California that say biking. I'm going biking, as sort of this, you know, youthful California style articulation, and Utah has it as well. So that's a more pan-Western youthful feature. And so you get this combination, but the pull merger and the fill feel merger, it's hard to say those words in rapid articulation separately, but F-I-L-L-F-E-E-L, those are often said the same way in Utah. And it's also in the back vowels. So it's pull, like P-U-L-L, and pool, P-O-O-L. If you say those together, oftentimes someone from Utah merges those as well. Yeah. And those seem to have been around for a long time. So unlike the biking feature, which is fairly new and young, a linguist by the name of Mariana DiPaolo wrote about that, I don't know, maybe 40, maybe 30 years ago, but a long time. It's been a long time. I don't want to age myself, but it was when in my youth that I remember reading that study. So it's been around for a while. And, you know, language changes no matter where you are or who you are. It's the natural course of language to change. It's also the natural course of young people to change language because they want to be nothing like their parents and everything like each other. Yeah. And so a lot of the things you're talking about would have been changes that were instigated by younger speakers as sort of acts of identity, acts of linguistic identity. Now, not consciously, but they do these things as they speak with one another due to speech accommodation. And of course, you accommodate to people you value or admire. So if someone cool in your high school is saying, you know, pull for pool and pull, you're going to start doing it even unconsciously. And that's how those slow changes make their way into our speech in identifiable patterns.
You know, a lot of the book is about the way this, our accents push just beyond language and sounds to attachment and identity and even emotion. And I wonder, when someone goes back home, they've lived away and they go back home and they slip back into the old accent when they see, you know, childhood friends or people in the old, you know, in hometown.
Right.
What's happening there?
I think what you really captured is this idea of the social importance of our accents, you know, just in even phrasing that question, this, when you go home, this, yeah. What does home mean?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, the comfy couch in your parents' basement where you had all these amazing memories and connections and friends. That's really the accent of home to you. And so it's about identity. If identity wasn't a piece of this puzzle, then we would not be altering our accents at all. But the very fact that we do suggests that what we're trying to do is reach different people and remind ourselves of different connections and ways of being that those accents are part of. And so, you know, when we were talking before about how you so-called lose an accent and you kind of take on features of a new accent, as I said, you never really lose that accent. It just becomes maybe a less dominant part of your speech. So we kind of have this blended accent. So when you're with your new people, you highlight the new features. Unconsciously, of course, you're not doing this thinking, huh, I'm gonna not merge pen and pen today, right? It doesn't happen that way. It's just that you start to, you know, kind of move towards using the things you hear in the speech around you more. So when you go back home, then all those things that were sort of latently in your speech and that you still subtly did, but you maybe had done them a little less, they come back because that's what people sound like around you. And it all gets back to this fact that interaction is crucial to the way that we speak, and speech accommodation, or this act of mirroring the people that we are talking to, also comes into play. So that's why we creep back into those patterns that we had when we used to live there, whenever we go back to where we live.
I want to come back finally to the inclination we have to judge the other accents that we hear. You write about this experiment from the 90s where researchers had college students listen to these audio recordings of a speaker giving a lecture. I think it was a woman from Ohio, so had an American accent, quote unquote. And then what the researchers did is they showed a photo to the students of the person they said was speaking. There's one photo of a white woman as the person who is giving the lecture, and some were given a photo of an Asian woman who was giving the lecture.
Yes.
What did that reveal?
Depending on which vision they gave them, which image they gave them, whether the American woman, the white woman's face, or the Asian woman's face, and I believe she was Chinese, the woman they showed a picture of, changed not only how accented they said that voice was, and remember they were hearing the same voice, but also how well they performed on a test testing the lecture material. So not only did they hear the voice differently in terms of, oh, she has an accent, she doesn't, but they didn't hear her as well when they thought she had an accent, even though they heard the identical speech. So that does suggest, right, that attitudes are getting in the way. But it actually turns out in later experiments not to be quite that simple. And we're not just all accent assholes waiting to, you know, give our attitudes a chance at court. We're also hearing people in ways that might cause us greater cognitive processing difficulties when they don't match the expectation we go into that task with.
Well, it leads to something you say finally that I wanted to ask you about, because, you know, as you sort of mentioned, noticing accents is an evolutionary trait or gift. But judging them, you say, is very much a product of our environment. So say something finally, would you, about how you sort of the thought you sort of end the book with, the idea that our accents don't always need to set us apart. They also bring us together. And maybe that's the thing you're hoping we'll connect to, that idea.
I think the big drive to writing this book is to sort of show people that if you pull back the layer that sounds like difference, which is what we attend to mostly when we listen to accents, if you pull back that layer, what you'll see is that no matter what the accent is, they're all driven by the same underlying linguistic principles and rules that drive our speech, no matter who we are or what we sound like, and the same need for connection and sort of social intimacy that we all are appealing to. And that accents are really the perfect example of how what sounds different on the surface is really part of the story of humanity more generally, and what should actually make us appreciate each other for being more alike than we realize. And so, you know, I think we can take two different reads off of accent. We can take the one that we often take, which is, oh, you're different and I don't like it. Or we can think, oh, you sound different, but the reason you sound different is for the same reasons I sound different. And in fact, let's sound different together, I think is sort of the fundamental story of this book.
Valerie Friedland, thank you very much.
It's been a blast. Thank you for having me.
Valerie Friedland. She's a professor of linguistics in the English department at the University of Nevada, Reno. Her book is Why We Talk Funny, The Real Story Behind Our Accents. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us on Instagram at Radio West or on YouTube at KUER 90.1. You can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Aidan Oneida, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.